Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
It is July the 25th. This is the third in our series on the Beis HaMikdash, A Pilgrim's Perspective. So we're going to discuss tonight the various sacrifices that one might bring and what they would have to do, what they would need, what are the materials to bring with them for the sacrifice. We've already talked about Tuma and Tara, about being pure and not being impure in order to go to the Beis HaMikdash. And last week we talked about where a person could walk in the Beis HaMikdash depending on their level of purity. And we started to talk about the sacrifices, but tonight we'll discuss the sacrifices in depth. Now we already, as I said, we already last week gave some information about it, but we're going to start over again because we're going to develop it in an organized fashion. Now, as we mentioned last week, there are several different types of sacrifices one could bring, and we'll take them in order. And as we do so, we'll talk about what type of animal does one have to bring, what are the restrictions about it, and in addition, are there different possibilities, meaning that does it have to be one type of animal, or could it be one or another or another? It's going to depend, because before a person goes to the Beis HaMikdash in order to offer a sacrifice, he has to have with him whatever he needs to offer the sacrifice. As we mentioned in the past 2 weeks, clearly there were vendors in and around the Beis HaMikdash that would have the necessary materials. Obviously, if the Beis HaMikdash, if people going to the Beis HaMikdash require different types of animals, birds, etc., then if you were a smart businessman, then you would open up a store selling those items near the Beis HaMikdash. So there were definitely vendors near the Beis HaMikdash, so you wouldn't have to bring one from Haifa, for example, all the way to Yerushalayim. At the same time, the Beis HaMikdash also offered certain things for sale because it made it something that there were different restrictions on what could be used, and the Beis HaMikdash had a storehouse worth of it, but they would sell to the public, be available to the public. Okay, so the first karbon that is discussed in the Chumash that we are going to discuss as well is the Ola, the karbon Ola. So Ola, we'll put it up over here on the board. Ola is spelled Ola. There's the transliteration Ola. Now an Ola could be either a sheep or a goat or a cow. It could be any of the three. A sheep, goat, or cow. Yes?
Where do we have the storage house? Where do we have all these animals?
Don't know. Outside? Yeah. What we didn't have, it was different vendors who had it. What's that?
But you said you said the make
other items. Not other items. We'll talk about it.
Okay.
So the Ola could be a sheep, a goat, or a cow. Which is, let's put over here a list of the various, we did this already last week, but let's put a list of the various types of animals that could be used as a karbon. So you could have a cow. You could have a we'll call it a young sheep. A lamb, thank you. An old sheep. A ewe, is that right? And a goat. Young sheep and old sheep are considered different categories for animals. When I say animals, I mean as opposed to birds and as opposed to flower, F-L-O-U-R. These different animals sometimes would be male, sometimes female, and even cows and goats, sometimes they would be older and sometimes younger, but they weren't considered a separate category. An old or young cow, male or female, all goes under the category of cows. Old or young goat, male or female, all goes under the category of goats. Sheep is divided up into two separate categories, young and old, and then of course we have male and female. The Hebrew will be par. There we go. Par. Par, I'm sorry for the... The young sheep is a keves. The older sheep is an ayil. And the goat would be a sa'ir. 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 I don't want to write S-A-I, it's not fair. Sa'ir. Those are your four different animals. I want to, as an aside, mention to you, the word ayil can be confusing because there's another word in Hebrew, which is ayol. Almost the same, it is the same letters, almost the same word, ayil and ayol. Ayil means an older sheep, a ram. And ayol is a deer. It's one of the words for deer. There are different types of words for deer or antelope, etc., like tzvi. Ayol is one of them. Ayil is a sheep, a ram. Now, all these animals here are in the category of behema. You know that in Hebrew there are two words to mean animal, either chaya or behema. Chaya generally means a wild animal. Behema generally means a domesticated animal. The animals that are used for karbanos, for sacrifices, have to be kosher, as sheep, goats, and cows are. And they have to be behema, that is, a domesticated animal, as opposed to a wild animal, even though there are kosher wild animals, like a deer. A deer is a kosher wild animal, but it cannot be used as a karban. A karban, a sacrifice, must come from behemos, from the domesticated animals, and they must be kosher. So they all have split hooves and chew their cud. The ola, I'm going to put this word a little closer because I want to add some other things in over here. The ola must be from a male animal. It cannot be female. It must be male, and it can be any of these animals, but it is male. So this is a distinguishing factor of an ola, is that it must be male. That is number one for an ola. Now, why would a person bring an ola? What would be the reason to bring an ola? So one could offer an ola just as a sacrifice because they want to bring a gift to the Beis HaMikdash, to the temple, and offer a sacrifice. There doesn't have to be a reason. One can bring an ola as a nidava, as a gift. And there would be no... one doesn't have to have done anything or have a purpose for it other than I want to do something as offer a carbon to the Beis HaMikdash. There were times where it was required to offer an ola, but many times it was not. The ola would atone for certain types of sins, particularly for sins that were done that would not fall into the category of chatas, of the typical sin offering, which we'll get to later. If a person committed a sin that would not warrant a chatas, a sin offering, and as we'll see later, a sin offering can only be brought when one is required to bring it. One cannot voluntarily offer a sin offering. If I didn't commit a sin that warrants a sin offering, I can't bring the sin offering. But there are sins that a person may do that doesn't fall into the category of chatas, of sin offering. An ola could be brought in its stead. One could offer an ola, because an ola could be brought voluntarily. It does not have to be brought for a specific sin. And therefore, some sins would achieve atonement through the ola. The ola could be an individual's sacrifice. That means any one of us could offer it. And many times, the tzibur, the congregation, must offer an ola. For example, all of the sacrifices that we read about when we daven Musaf either on Shabbos or on Rosh Chodesh or any of the holidays. So you'll notice when you go through the Shemona Esrei of Musaf, there's a paragraph in there that says that when the Beis HaMikdash will be rebuilt, we will offer such and such sacrifices, because the Musaf, which means additional, is additional sacrifices that were brought depending on the day, depending on whether it was Shabbos or Rosh Chodesh or whatever. The Musaf is an Ola. An Ola, a Musaf is a type of Ola. It was an animal that was brought as a carbon Ola. The Ola is not eaten at all by anybody. It is burned on the altar, and that is that. The like with any sacrifice, the blood is thrown on the altar. It is skinned. The skin is kept by the Kohanim, and the meat is all burned. There's nothing that is consumed from the Ola. But if, for our purposes, if a person wanted to bring an Ola, he would have to find one of these animals, and it would have to be male. In addition to it being male, what else is required of any animal that is brought as a carbon?
Unblemished.
It has to be tamim. Unblemished. Tamim. That is required for all these animals. Well, tamim is plural. I'll put it in the singular. Tam. Tam. Tam or tam. Which is unblemished. What does the word tam remind you of? Not good. Not good.
Okay.
That would be with a tes. Oh. That would be spelled like this.
Okay.
Ta'am. That would be taste. But what does the word tam remind you of? Perhaps something that we all...
It reminds me of tamid.
Okay. It is the first two letters of the word tamid. That is true. But what does it remind you of? Something that we all participate in every year. Anybody think of something that we participate in every year? There are four of this, and this is one of them. Okay. The word for the simple son, the Chacham, the wise son, the Rasha, the evil son, the Tam. The Tam in the Haggadah is taken to mean the simple one. But you see here, Tam really means unblemished. There's a certain purity, a certain simplicity to the tam. That's what tam means. Sometimes it can mean a person who isn't sharp, who isn't wily. You understand why the word tam might mean that. But it is not used as a negative when it's talking about Yaakov Avinu. Yaakov is called Ish Tam, a simple man. Which means he didn't have the designs of his brother Esav. He was not a fool. He was not an ignoramus. He was a very intelligent person. But he was more simple. He wasn't a complicated person like his brother Esav. In contrast to Esav, he was a tam. He was simple, straightforward. You saw what you got. Tam here means unblemished. Pure. That's what tam means in this context. That is an Ola. Now, the truth is that one could also offer, instead of animals, one could offer a bird as an Ola. But I want to leave that for later. We're going to treat birds separately. Right now, we're only going to deal with animal carbonos, and we'll get to birds and flower, F-L-O-U-R, later. Yeah. I think that it was offered fairly regularly. In the Beis HaMikdash? Yeah, there was meat burning all the time. Oh yeah. Yeah. One of the constant miracles of the Beis HaMikdash, which we mentioned in previous years, is that there were no flies in the Beis HaMikdash, in the place where they skinned the animals and cut them into the pieces, and then they washed the intestines, etc. There were no flies. You would have expected there to be flies because there was meat and there was, you know, they were it was a slaughterhouse, but they didn't have that was one of the miracles. There were no flies. So that is the Ola. Let us move now to the one I just mentioned before, which is the Chatos. The Chatos, which is a sin offering, comes from the word Chet, which means to sin. That is a sin offering. A Chatos, in contrast to the Ola, must be female, cannot be male. It must be female, and it can only be a young sheep or a goat. A female young sheep or a female goat. Those are your two choices for a chatas. It cannot be a cow and it cannot be an old sheep. It must be one of these two.
Can it be an old goat?
What's that?
Can it be an old goat? Yeah.
I don't think it matters. I don't think it matters. So that is a chatas. The chatas also has to remain unblemished, as with all of the behemoths, as with all of these animals that are being offered. The chatas would be brought by someone who committed a sin, who needs atonement. Now, what type of sin would warrant a chatas? Not all sins, as I mentioned before, would warrant a chatas. In order for a sin to warrant a chatas, and it would be a good thing if this sin warranted a chatas, because then one had a way of achieving atonement fairly easily. One could just offer the sacrifice and they have achieved atonement. So what type of sins warrant a chatas? It would have to be that one violated a prohibition as opposed to not performing a commandment, meaning that if someone did not eat matzah on Pesach, that would not warrant a chatas, even though it is an avera. Even though it is a sin not to eat matzah on Pesach deliberately, that is a sin, but a chatas would not be brought for that, because that's not violating a prohibition. That is not performing a commandment. A chatas has to be violating a prohibition. And it has to be a prohibition that has an action attached to it. So, for example, there is a prohibition in the Torah, as we all know: do not speak lashon hara. One is not allowed to speak lashon hara, as we know that from the Torah itself. But that would not warrant a chatas. One who did speak lashon hara would not offer a chatas, because speaking is not considered to be an action. However, the prohibition against do not eat pork, eating is an action. Therefore, one who deliberately ate pork and knew better would offer a chatas. Yeah.
I thought it was an unintentional.
Yes, yes, you are correct. When I keep saying deliberate, what I meant by deliberate, you're correct. Deliberate is wrong. When I kept saying deliberate, what I meant to say is that one knew about it beforehand, as opposed to someone who never knew that they're not supposed to eat pork. But someone who knew they were not supposed to eat pork and then inadvertently ate it, they either forgot that they're not supposed to eat pork, didn't realize this was a piece of pork, and ate it, then they would offer a chatas. Thank you very much. A deliberate transgression would not warrant a chatas, even if it fits the parameters of a prohibition with an action. Still, it would not warrant a chatas if it was done deliberately. So, most of the prohibitions in the Torah, or I should say many of the prohibitions in the Torah, do warrant a chatas. So if we go through in our minds the various prohibitions, someone who violates Shabbos, someone forgot it was Shabbos and cooked on Shabbos, or forgot that it's prohibited to cook on Shabbos and cooked on Shabbos, would offer a chatas. As I mentioned in previous weeks, a that there was a sage in the Talmud who had an oil lamp, and if one has an oil lamp on Shabbos and tips the lamp in order to make it burn better, that is a prohibition of burning a fire on Shabbos, even though the fire is already burning. But if one tips the lamp so that the oil will flow better into the fire and burn better, that is a prohibition of burning on Shabbos. This sage was studying on Shabbos at the light of an oil lamp, forgot that it was Shabbos, and tilted the lamp in order to make it burn better. When he realized his mistake, he wrote in his ledger that when the Beis HaMikdash shall be rebuilt, I will offer a chatas. Because he had sinned, he had forgotten, and he had sinned with transgressing Shabbos, which requires a chatas. Not kosher food would require a chatas. That's an action, it's a prohibition, it would require a chatas. One who would eat chametz on Pesach would require a chatas. That's a prohibition. Do not eat chametz on Pesach. If one did that and knew they weren't supposed to do it and then forgotten and did it anyway, forgot it was Pesach, forgot that this was chametz, then they would offer a chatas. Yes.
So suppose somebody doesn't
know about Judaism, because they're
Jewish, and they don't eat kosher, or they don't eat matzah, or they make bread. So
do they have to do a chatas for the baby? There is a discussion in the Gemara. If someone who never knew, then they it seems that they would have to bring one for all of the times that they did it. In other words, if a person is 50 years old and then finally learned that they were not supposed to eat pork, and they've eaten pork hundreds of times since they were 13 or 12, then they would offer a chatas, one for all of that, for all of those. However, there is a discussion in the Gemara whether it would be one chatas for all sins or a chatas for each category of sin. Now, Shabbos would get one, kosher food would get another, chametz on Pesach would get another. That's a discussion in the Gemara. I don't know the answer. We will find out, hopefully, very soon. But I don't know the answer.
Example you gave us individual who did a sin, unintentional
shgaga.
So what about if your ox goes,
your
other man's ox, and then you have to pay, you know,
you pay. There's no sacrifice to offer. No. That is a chatas. That is a chatas. Again, a chatas, just like an ola, could be a bird, but we'll get to that later. We'll get to birds later. But right now we're focusing only on the animals. The chatas is another type of sacrifice. Now, I've told you so far about individuals sinning. There can be a communal chatas that is offered. And for example, on every one of the Yamim Tovim, on the holidays, including Rosh Chodesh, in addition to the Musaf that has the Ola, as I told you, the Musaf has the Ola, but besides that, on each of those days, there is one communal chatas that is offered as well, as part of the Musaf. The Musaf can be multiple sacrifices. On Shabbos, it's two sacrifices, two olos. On Rosh Chodesh, for example, it is 10 different olos. But in addition to those, there is one chatas that is offered, a communal chatas. What is it atoning for? Various communal possible sins that it is atoning for. But it is legislated in the Torah that it is offered at every holiday. A chatas. So it doesn't have to be individual. There can be communal chatas as well. There is another type of sin offering, which, as I mentioned last week, is much more specific than the chatas. The chatas, as I just told you, is a much more general type of sin offering. Prohibitions that have an action. But there's another type which is very specific, only to very specific circumstances, and that is called an asham. An asham. Now, asham, we can't get into all the details of asham because they are very, very many. And it would take a lot of the time just to talk about Asham. So I am not here going to tell you every detail of Asham. I'm not even going to tell you all the types of Asham. I'm going to give you a general discussion of Asham, in which case I'm only going to touch on most of the Ashamas. There are different types of Ashams. What I'm telling you now applies to most of them, but not all of them. And the Asham must be an old sheep, a ram, and it has to be male. A male, and it is a ram. That is what an Asham is. Not only that, the Torah even says how much it has to cost. It has to be worth at least 2 shekelim. You're familiar with the half shekel. The Asham must cost at least 2 shekelim. At least 2 shekelim. I'll put shekels. Now, I can't tell you whether that's very easy to find or difficult to find, because I'm not sure how that works out. I don't think 2 shekels is that expensive. But, nevertheless, the Torah does give a price for the Asham. What types of things would require an Asham? So, as I said, there are many different types of Ashamos. One example, and perhaps the easiest one to deal with, and the one that I think most people are familiar with, if they're familiar with any Asham, is the Asham Talui. What's an Asham Talui? Talui literally means hanging. The hanging Asham. What do you mean, the hanging Asham? It's like, you'll remember from a few years back, the hanging Chad. That's what it means of the Asham Talui. What do I mean by the hanging Asham? Because if someone did something that might require a chatas, but they're not sure. A person ate a piece of meat and then found out later it might have been not kosher, but they don't know. They're not sure. We don't have any definitive evidence as to whether what they ate was kosher or not kosher. In that case, if we would find out that it was certainly not kosher, then the chatas would be offered. But because we're not sure, instead, the Asham Talui, the hanging Asham, is offered. Hanging meaning that it hangs in the balance. As long as we have a doubt as to what the person did, the Asham is sufficient. If at any point in the future it is discovered that he really did eat not kosher meat, then he would have to offer the Chatas. The Asham takes the place of the Chatas as long as we are unsure as to whether he actually committed the sin or not. That's an Asham Talui, a hanging Asham. As I said, that's not the only Asham, but that's an example of an Asham. There are Ashamos, there's Ashams that are offered by, for instance, someone who had Tzara'as and is now becoming pure from their Tzara'as. One of the things he has to do is offer an Asham. A Nazir, someone who took the vow of being a Nazir at the end of their term of being a Nazir, also one of the things they do is offer an Asham. Those are very specific Ashams. But the Asham that I'm talking about is more general than the Asham Talui. That's Asham.
Is it possible to offer the Asham and then find out you have to offer the Asham?
Yes, yes. A person could offer the Asham and then the next day discover that they really did the sin, and then they got to go back and offer a Chatas.
So the Asham wouldn't be in vain or anything?
No. The Asham is not in vain. It takes care of the problem until you find out otherwise. There is a sage in the Mishnah that offered an Asham every day for fear that they may have, the sage was afraid he may have transgressed, and therefore offered an Asham every day. The other sages said, no, you shouldn't do that, unless you really do have a specific case that you can point to and say that I don't know if I sinned or not, then the Asham should not be offered. But I'm just showing you that there is such an opinion that the Asham is something to do because it takes care of potential sin. Yeah.
Would
It is traditional Judaism. It's what the Torah says to do. Today, nobody does it because we don't have a temple.
But if the temple would be built,
then everybody would do it. Yeah. Torah says to do it. Yes. 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 Women would do it as well. We mentioned last time that often the women would send the sacrifice with their husbands or with somebody else to the temple because it was a trip. And as is often the case with a family, it's a lot easier for the husband to get away than it is for the wife to get away. So very often they would send it with their husband. But a woman also, there was a special place for the women to go to bring their sacrifices in the temple, a special entrance. And yes, women would offer sacrifices. And as we mentioned also in the past couple of weeks, one of the people who has to offer a sacrifice is a woman who gave birth. Childbirth is one of the reasons to offer a sacrifice. So then certainly the women would come to offer their sacrifice.
And what sacrifice
would
that be?
We'll hopefully we'll get to that. I hope we'll get to it. Yeah.
Has anybody ever thought to analyze the logic behind why it's holy to kill an animal?
It has been discussed extensively. I don't want to get sidetracked into that now because here we're trying to discuss the specifics of what one has to do. However, animals were created for this purpose. This is the holiest point an animal can possibly reach. Animals would be privileged to be offered as a sacrifice. Yes?
You mentioned that an olah could be given just to give it a sacrifice. Now, would that be part of what you're required as tzedakah? Or is it different?
It's not tzedakah. No.
What?
It would be a mitzvah of offering a sacrifice.
So, do you have a desire to be close to Hashem? Do you go when you offer? Is that? I mean, you don't just do anything just because, you know, you want to do something to be close to Hashem.
Yeah, it would be a way of connecting. It would be a way of connecting. Now, the next category of sacrifices would be a shlamim. I think we're going to have to retire this one. Let's see. Let's use a different pen. The shlamim, which I'll write on the board in a moment. Shlamim comes from the word shalom and is a peace offering. Shlamim. The shlamim was the most flexible of all sacrifices. It could be male or female. And it could be any of these animals. The shlamim could be any of them, and male or female. A shlamim was generally offered because one wanted to. There were rarely a requirement. Sometimes there was a requirement, but most of the time it was not a requirement to offer a shlamim. It is not being brought for a sin. It was brought as a sacrifice, just as a sacrifice. And the difference between the shlamim and the previous three is the ola, as we said, is completely burned. There is no eating of the meat. The chatas and the asham, part of the meat is eaten, but not by the person who offered the sacrifice. The meat is eaten by who? The Kohanim. They would eat the meat. The Shlamim would be, part of it would be burned. There would be a small part that was offered to the Kohen, but the bulk of it, most of it, was eaten by the person offering the sacrifice. Therefore, it was, if you want to put it this way, a holy barbecue. As if a person wanted to have a nice meal with his family, they were in Yerushalayim, and they wanted to do it in a way which would be, let's say they were making a large gathering, they were celebrating a 50th anniversary, and they wanted to have a large amount of people there, friends and family, and they were doing it in Yerushalayim, they wouldn't just go out to a fancy restaurant, they would offer a shlamim, which would be a sacrifice to the temple, and it would be a mitzvah, and then the meat would be eaten by the people. That would be a shlamim. In fact, the way the Torah presents shlamim is that there is a specific discussion in the Torah in Parashas Re'eh about eating meat just because. just because you like eating meat. Until that point in the Torah, eating meat was only discussed as something you do when you offer a sacrifice. When basar taiva, when eating meat just for pleasure, is mentioned in the Torah, the way the Torah says it is, if you are not near the temple, because I'm going to bring you into the land of Israel, and then you're going to scatter through the land of Israel, and you may live far away from the temple, and then you're going to want to eat meat, but you'll be too far away to offer a sacrifice, it's okay. You can eat meat. That's the way the Torah presents it. It's almost like the default way of eating meat is to offer a shlamim. That's almost like the default. That's what you really, that would be the best way to do it. You're living near the temple, so if you're going to eat meat, offer a shlamim. But because you're living far away, or you're living outside of Israel, then it's okay, you can eat meat also. You don't need to offer a shlamim. But shlamim seems to be the default method of eating meat. You're having a party, you offer a shlamim. That's what it seems to be. But the shlamim is a regular sacrifice. It's the one that can be any animal, any of these animals, male, female, and it is eaten by the person offering the sacrifice along with his friends and family. Yes.
So let's say you have three families that want to offer the shlamim, and say one came at 8 in the morning, or one came at noon, and say all three came at noon. It takes a while to cook. So would it matter if you had three, let's say, goats? Who got what? In other words...
Well, somebody owns it.
Huh?
Somebody owns it. You can't just take somebody else's.
They have three goats, right? So they cooked all the three goats on the grill?
They could. I mean, it's whatever they offered. There is a requirement to eat the meat within a certain amount of time.
So what I'm asking is their goats and their meat?
Yeah.
It couldn't be somebody else's?
No. No, it was yours, and then you either ate it yourself, or most likely you invited people to eat it with you because it was too much to eat.
They kept track.
It was tagged. Listen, if they can do it in Hartsfield Jackson with luggage, they can do it there also.
It takes time.
Let me give you some examples of shlamim which you are familiar with. For instance, a karban toda, a Thanksgiving offering, is a form of a shlamim. It's a type of shlamim. Obviously, that's offered for a specific thing. If a person wants to thank Hashem for something specific, if a person had a wonderful thing happen to them, they would go to the Beis HaMikdash and offer a toda, which is a form of a shlamim, a karban toda. Another type of shlamim is the famous karban Pesach. The karban Pesach, the Pesach sacrifice, is a form of a shlamim. In fact, if a person designated an animal as their karban Pesach, this is going to be my animal which I'm going to offer for Pesach. The person did that. And then for whatever reason, they were unable to offer the sacrifice. For whatever, something came up, and now they were unable to offer it. And now it's past Pesach. What do you do with the animal? You offer it as a shlamim. It becomes a shlamim because Pesach is a form of shlamim, eaten by the people themselves, etc.
Going
to
be a shlamim anyway.
Well, it's not. It was a specific. It was a Pesach. Pesach is very specific. Yeah. So those are your four main animal type of sacrifices. And so, if a person wants to offer any of these things, or needs to offer any of these things, they need to get a hold of the correct animal. In addition to the animal, though, there is more that one has to bring. And I hope we have enough time to get through everything over here. In addition to the animals, one also has to bring nisachim. Nisachim literally means libations, but it's really a loosely applied term. The word nisachim, let me just switch pens over here. The word nisachim which again literally means libations, included three additional items that are brought along with the sacrifice, and the amount of what they would bring depended on the category of animal. And this is why we have four categories, as I'll show you in a moment. What would one bring as nesachim? Nesachim would include wine, oil, and flour. This is not to be confused with a mincha, which is a flour offering. This is not a flour offering per se. A flour offering would be without the animal, just the flour by itself. This is flour which is brought along with the animal as part of nisachim, as part of the libations that go along with the animal. Wine, oil, and flour. How much wine, oil, and flour depended on the category of animal. The cow, the par, got the largest amount of wine, flour, and oil. The ayol, the older sheep, the ram, got the second tier. And then the sheep or the goat got the third tier. No, the cow got the most. The ram is second, and the sheep and goat together, the young sheep and the goat, are the third tier. And that's why we divide up the old sheep and young sheep into two categories, because they have different requirements for the amount of nisachim. How much would one have to bring? So let's talk about the flour first, because there we have a point of reference. The flour, one would have to bring three. The measurement we're going to use is isaron. Isaron is literally means a tenth. Comes from the word eser, ten. Isaron. And the what is it? A tenth of. It's a tenth of an ephah. What is a tenth of an ephah? A tenth of an ephah is the same amount as an omer. You'll say, what do you mean as an omer? Isn't omer something that we count? Yes. But omer is also a measurement. And that is also the amount of dough, of flour, that a woman would use and then have to separate challah. If you're baking challah, if you're baking, not just challah, you're baking anything. You're making pizza. You're making cookies. Then you use the correct amount of flour. Then one has to then separate challah from the dough. Today we burn it, and in the time of the Beis Hamikdash we would give it to the Kohen. How much flour is that? So it is 43.2. 43 and a fifth bayim eggs. 43.2 eggs. The volume of 43.2 eggs, that is the size of an isaron. So if you can think in your mind the amount of dough that you may have used at a certain point and separated challah, that would be an isaron, that amount of dough. Today when different rabbis offer the amounts, they talk in terms of weight, which is not really accurate, because it's not meant to be a weight, it's really a volume. But since it's a lot easier to measure weight than volume, we estimate that an omer is around 4.5-5 pounds of flour. That would be an isaron. That would be an isaron. And that is one isaron would be the amount of flour one has to offer for the lowest tier, for the young sheep or the goat. Two esronos for the aisle, for the old sheep. Three esronim for the par, for the cow. Those are the amounts of flour of nisachim that one would have to bring when one offered one of these animals as a sacrifice. The flour would have to be fine flour. It has to be wheat flour. And it has to be not just ground in a fine way, it also has to be without the chaff or the bran. It has to be a very white flour. So the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, would have much of this on hand available to sell to people. so that they would be able to have it. Otherwise, it may be hard to find this type of flour. The wine and the oil works with measurements of fractions of a hin. A hin is a measurement in the Torah. One hin, H-I-N, hin. One hin, one is a measurement in the Torah. And the Torah speaks in terms of fractions of the hin, which is that half a hin of wine or oil would be the amount for the cow, for the par. A third of a hin of wine and oil would be the amount for the ayil, for the old sheep. And a quarter of a hin of wine and oil would be the amount for the young sheep and the goat. You'll ask me, how much is a hin? I don't know 100%. And not because, well, let me guess one second, hold on. Not because we don't know, not because I don't know. Let me see if I can... I don't know. Can I give a? I don't know off the top of my head exactly how much that is, how much each of those measurements are, but it follows the same pattern that the cow gets the largest amount, the old sheep is second, the young sheep and the goat are third. Yes.
You're talking about eggs that you crack and the volume of the crack
egg. Yeah. Of course, they're different size eggs. You know. Yeah. Okay. Now, there are times that a person can offer a bird rather than an animal. A bird cannot be an asham or a shlamim. A bird can only be an ola or a chatas. Ola or a chatas, excuse me, could be a bird. So it could be a bird. What type of bird? So we mentioned last week, the birds are either a tar or a benyona, which is a dove, or a turtle dove they call it, and a tar, which seems to be a pigeon. Those are the two types of birds. It has to be a kosher bird, but birds do not need to be unblemished. A bird that is not tam, that is a balmum, that has a blemish, is acceptable as a sacrifice. A bird is acceptable. However, it cannot be missing a limb. It is okay if it has a blemish, but it is not okay if it is missing a limb. That is a bird. And it can be either an ola or a chatas. Now, if you're bringing the ola voluntarily, then you can bring a bird rather than an animal. But if you're bringing it in an obligatory way, and the chatas is always obligatory, then most of the time you cannot use a bird. You have to use an animal. There are specific examples in the Torah where the Torah says it is permissible to substitute an animal for a bird. A bird is a lot less expensive than an animal.
Substitute a bird for
bird for an animal, right. Because, and one would do that because a bird is a lot less expensive than an animal and it would save a lot of money. So there are certain types of sins and certain types of situations where it is permissible to substitute. Childbirth is one of those examples where there would be an animal that is offered, but if a woman can't afford that, then a bird could be substituted in place of the animal. And it's just as good. Correct. That's correct. That's birds. Birds. Okay, let's leave it at that because we're running out of time. The other type. You want a question? Processed. They must have moved pretty quickly because I imagine there were a lot of carbonas each day and they had to move pretty quickly. I imagine that they processed it quickly. What happened is that you had a Kohen who would take charge of your particular sacrifice. You'd bring a sacrifice to the Beis HaMikdash. a kohen would come, and you could talk to one particular kohen who was there at the time, or one would just come up to you and say, okay, what do you need? And then that kohen would process your particular karban. And that's how you would keep tabs on your karban. It's not that that kohen couldn't enlist anybody else's help, but he would be your direct connection as it was being processed. And so you'd know what was going on. And if you had, on any given day, you had 100 kohanim there, so they could process 100 karbanos at a time. It's a very, very large altar. So there's room. It doesn't have to be only one at a time. There's a lot of room to move around.
Was he also bigger than this
space? The altar, the top of the altar was 24 amos by 24 amos, which is about 40 feet by 40 feet at the top of the altar. That's large.
And he would come back and report to you, like, when it was...
Depending on the type of carbon. Yeah, if you... I mean, certainly if it was a shlomen where you needed the meat, he would give it back to you.
Yeah,
right? Right.
Okay, yeah.
You know. But yes, yeah, he should report back to you. And generally speaking, that's what would happen.
And he always
had enough... So the Gemara discusses that on Erev Pesach, which was the busiest time of the year, because... all Jews had to be involved in a Karban Pesach. They all had to at least be included in a Karban Pesach. And it had to be done in the afternoon of the day before Pesach. So you had a very little time and a lot of karbanos. So the Mishnah discusses the system that they had in order to process many karbanos very quickly. So they had actually Kohanim lined up in assembly line style, just passing different things to each other, etc., in order to get it moving. But that was a very specific time of the year. Most of the time it wasn't that busy. Yeah.
Didn't firstborn animals have to be...
Yes.
Where did they...
Okay, that is a bechor, which is actually another type of sacrifice. But it is... Let's include that in shlamim for our purposes. It's not really exactly like a shlamim because it's only a male, not a female, and it was given to the kohen. It's a little bit of a different type of thing, but that is a more specific type of carbon. There are a lot of specific ones that we're not covering. That, you know, these are the general categories. Finally, we have mincha. Mincha is a flour offering, not included in the nesachim, but as a separate category called mincha. A mincha is a flour offering. One could bring a mincha, a flour offering, as a voluntary sacrifice, a flour offering. And then, as with the birds, there were certain types of sacrifices that one could substitute the flour offering instead of the animal or the bird, depending on what the type of reason for the sacrifice was. With childbirth, that was not acceptable. Childbirth, it would have to be either an animal or a bird. But there were other types of sacrifices or required sacrifices where the flour could be used instead. The types of flour offerings were varied. There were many types of flour offerings, and what they did with the flour depended on the type of flour offering that was being given. Whether it was fried, or whether it was baked, depending on what was being offered, it would be prepared accordingly. The flour offering came along with two things. It came along with, what's that? Oil, and spices. Levona, spices. The flour offering had to have those two things along with it, oil and spices. That were brought.
Mincha offering or
flour offering? Mincha is, flour is the English. Mincha is the Hebrew. It's mincha. Just like the way we daven mincha, that's the same word. I'll put in parentheses flour.
Did they ever use honey?
What's that?
Did they ever use honey?
No, they were not allowed to use honey. There's actually a pasuk in the Torah not to bring honey. What's that?
So hold on.
The mincha offering was always matzah. It was never chametz. Always matzah. As I've mentioned many times, the Beis Hamikdash was Pesach all year round. It was kosher Pesach all year round. There was always matzah. Except for Shavuos. That's one example. Shavuos, there are two exceptions. Shavuos, the Shtei HaLechem, the two loaves that were offered on Shavuos were chametz. And if one brought a Karban Toda, the Thanksgiving offering, which as I mentioned before is a type of shlamim, it came along with 40 loaves of bread. You had to bring, in addition to the shlamim, you had to bring 40 loaves of bread. 30 of those were matzah, 10 were chametz. So there was some chametz, but it was mostly matzah. It was mostly matzah. So, if you were offering any of these things, the mincha, for example, you had to bring flour, and then you also had to bring oil and spices to bring to the Beis HaMikdash to be used for this particular sacrifice or this particular offer. Yes?
So, when we talk about King and
The Gemara says that if someone can't afford it, then they bring the flour offering is the cheapest of all the offerings. So the Gemara says, Echad hamarba ve'echad hamamit, whether one does a lot or one does a little, as long as he directs his heart to our Father in heaven. This is where it's said. That phrase is applied to many different things, but it's said about sacrifices. That's where that statement is made. We have not discussed a lot of the details. There's so many, many more details that have to do with these sacrifices. We're really out of time and we can't get into all the other points that there are to cover. But you see a general idea of what you'd have to bring with you when going to the Beis HaMikdash. So we covered the becoming pure, which is a necessary step in order to visit the Beis HaMikdash, and we discussed where one can go in the Beis HaMikdash, and these are the items one would bring with them when visiting the Beis HaMikdash to use as an offering. All of these things were different types of commodities that were necessary in visiting the Beis HaMikdash. One could go without these things. One could go just to visit. One could go just to, for example, see the Kohen Gadol perform the service on Yom Kippur. One is not required to go, but one could go. One could go at any time to the Beis HaMikdash. But it was meritorious, if you were going to come, not to come empty-handed, but to bring something as an offering to the Beis HaMikdash. That would be the typical thing one would do when one would visit the Beis HaMikdash. Just think that what time do we have? We're over time? What's that? Yeah, we're over time.
So our prayers today are taking the place of
That is correct.
The tamid.
The carbon tamid, the daily sacrifice of the Beis HaMikdash, was a communal ola. That was a communal ola.
And then,
the mincha is the other tamid. There are two tamidim, one in the morning, one in the afternoon. Right. Correct.
That was also an
mincha literally means gift. That's literally what it means. Yes. I don't know. I don't know.
I don't remember exactly, but I remember reading that had tremendous strength.
He did.
He did.
No, I just lifted them up.
Okay.
Wave them like we do with a lulav and
esrog. A little what?
Like we do with a lulav and esrog.
Yeah, so that's.
Yeah, but not twirl them around. Just,
well, I didn't.
Yeah. Yeah, but not like the kaparas, you know, not like
the time, not the kaparas. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, one and done. But I don't know. I don't know what will happen in the future. Yeah. It was a very big place. I don't know if that was one. It doesn't say that is one of the miracles. That the people all fit is one of the miracles. But I don't know that all the... Yeah, okay. That's a good point. That's a good point. Everybody and their luggage. Right. That's a good point.
I mean, even within Eretz Yisrael...
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And were they singing on the steps while these things were going...
Yeah.
They
yeah.
were singing.
Mm-hmm.
They were singing to
Elam. They were singing to Elam, yeah. Yeah. Not the whole day. Different parts of the day. Yeah.
Just a question. The word kapara, atonement, is that supposed to be like kapara, like a part?
Interesting. I don't know. Very interesting. I don't know if that, I don't know. No, that's very nice. Yeah.
I found something very interesting related to the Beis Hamikdash. It says the 10 miracles that happened at Beis Hamikdash. It says, no premature birth was ever caused by the odor of the holy flesh being sacrificed.
Mm-hmm.
The holy flesh never became putrid. And you said no fire was ever seen in the storehouse, which was the same as no action causing uncleanliness ever befell the Kohen Gadol on the day of atonement and Yom Kippur. No defect was ever found in either the Omer, the new barley offered on the second day of Pesach, or the two-wave loaves, the first was the wheat harvest offered on Sukkot. On Shavuot, or on the show of bread. The next one is though the people stood close and pressed together, they found ample space to plaster themselves. No serpent or scorpion ever injured a person in Shalayim. Number eight, no person ever said to spell the place to grab for me to lodge over Nayu Shalayim. The ninth, the rain never quenched the fire of the wood pile on the Mizbeah. And ten, the column of smoke that rose from the Mizbeah could not be diverted from its course even by the strongest wind.
Very nice. Very nice.
Can I just put one more question?
Yeah.
Rabbi Kresge, you said that most of it was matzah. So was it matzah in Sarah's tent? Or would we have loaves? We make challah in Greece.
No, Sarah's tent would be bread.
It would be bread with
yeah.
loaves.
Yeah.
Why was the matzah there?
In the Beis Hamikdash. It's one of the rules in the Torah.
But it was fluffy. It was called matzah.
Yeah, it wasn't matzah, like brittle matzah. It was more like Sephardi matzah. Yeah, whatever it is. But it still wasn't fluffy. It wasn't like, you know. So, okay, we should merit to see this all speedily and in our days.
Amen. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.